You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of January 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. This is Emma Nelson, and on today's show, NATO begins 2018 with the same problem as last year. What to do about Russia? But is it any better prepared? My guests Marie Billon and Sebastian Borger will discuss this and the day's other top issues, including appeasement. It's been a dirty word in politics for some time, but what does it mean? And my button's bigger than your button. We dust off our kiddie-sized boxing gloves and examine the childish game of nuclear-sized posturing. All that, plus...
And good morning, everybody. Welcome to today. It's 2018, and we are kicking off the year right because Hoda is officially the co-anchor of today. Let's give her a round of applause.
Hoda Kotb replaces Matt Lauer as co-anchor of NBC's Today Show. It means for the first time, two women will permanently host a key US breakfast show. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. And a reassuring lack of whooping and applause in Studio One today, but nonetheless, an appetite for some good debate. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Marie Billon, who's a UK correspondent for French media, and Sebastian Borger, the London correspondent for the Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both to the programme. I shall not applaud, just smile. Now, we begin with NATO. New year, same headache. They begin 2018 with a continued challenge of what to do about Russia. The annexation in 2014 of Crimea remains at the top of NATO's to-do list. Late last month, the US Marine Corps Commandant General Robert Neller told American troops to be ready for the full spectrum of conflict. But how ready can they be when even senior NATO figures have admitted they've taken their eye off the ball when it comes to being efficient, effective, or ready? Sebastian, there was an assumption a mere 5 years ago that Russia would never be a threat again. And now when you read articles in the likes of Le Monde a couple of months ago, the FT recently, everybody questions whether the alliance could even be strong enough to withstand an invasion.
Well, I mean, let's remember one thing. In the 70s and 80s, we always knew if the Soviet troops, as they were back then, had decided to invade Germany, the famous Fulda Gap was talked about, and realistic scenarios said the Russians could be on the Rhine within 3 or 4 days. So it's not actually about can you prevent an invasion. What you're talking about is are you showing enough force and enough determination for it not to happen. That's the whole purpose. I mean, there are all these funny scenarios making the rounds that Russian troops could be in Tallinn, the capital of Estonia, within 60 hours. So that's by the by. Yes, of course they could. No problem at all. It's pretty flat there, and you can't. What can you do? But the fact is, are we politically, first of all, are we politically engaged in a dialogue with Russia, which in a meaningful dialogue, which means it's got to be meaningful from both sides. And but secondly, have we got something in place which deters military adventurism, of which Putin has form. We've seen it in Georgia in 2008, and we've obviously seen it in Ukraine in 2014. And let's not forget, this is another election year. He might want to give a sign of his Russian patriotism. Don't underestimate the man.
It is one of those interesting situations that, in the absence of an ideology such as communism, which has sustained the Cold War's reason for such a long time, perhaps NATO decided that actually just pure national pride, pure desire to push powerful boundaries as far as they could is something that was no longer relevant to them.
We've been looking, in a way rightly, at the end of the 20th, early 21st century, at power, national power in broader terms. Rightly, I would say, soft power has become much more important. That's true. But and we see in Russia, of course, a declining population, a declining GDP. We see a terrible health problems in the health service. I mean, anything that the NHS moans about here in Britain pales into insignificance to what people in Russia have to endure. What we haven't reckoned with is the old concept of Russian imperialism. That's basically at the bottom of all this. Particularly, I suppose, with a population which can't be happy about their economic and social circumstances, it's always easy for a leader to turn outwards and be aggressive.
And combined with that, Marie, NATO has had to deal with new challenges which perhaps it could not have foreseen, the likes of individual governments cutting back on military spending, that no longer being a priority in politics. And secondly, the arrival of Donald Trump, who shook everything up last year.
Yes, of course. You have to work with the reality, and you have to work with what the individual country decided to say. And it's true that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, NATO and individual countries decided that the threat of war was less acute, less present, and that downsizing in the military was a good idea because you could use the money for something else. And also because having a less big military also looks less aggressive. So there will be less chances somehow that it will be war because there are less soldiers and less tanks around the world. That's a vision that was on well and good until Russia decided to flex the muscle. That's exactly basically what Trump is saying. Trump is saying that we've been too kind for many years, and now the bad people, to talk like he does, are taking advantage of it. And NATO has a point in a way, saying that we have perhaps trimmed down too much and we are not ready in case something happens, and now we have to realize that something might be happening and we have to get ready. They don't want to talk about, you know, a new Cold War when you have to basically be ready with arms to hands. They talk about redynamization of the military of NATO and other countries, so more put back dynamic into the military of the NATO and the countries, meaning that exactly the same thing somehow, less politically perhaps, but is the same thing that Cold War, just being ready just in case.
These are the things that the unknown unknowns, the things such as, as we've just mentioned just then, the idea of governments cutting back, etc. But a senior NATO official has said that the alliance is looking at all the things we forgot to do and accepted that there were some points that they all missed. For example, cyber attacks in Estonia as far back as 2007. 2008. Did NATO really take its eye off the ball, Sebastian?
Well, I mean, to be fair, of course, the cyber attacks were new. People had to adapt to that. I think that is happening, and we've seen cyber attacks in the other direction. I think it's fair to say that the Iranian nuclear program was severely damaged by either U.S. or Israeli cyber attack, and I would be very surprised if the UK and indeed the US didn't have the means to severely damage Russian infrastructure if that was necessary. But we've heard it a number of times from different theatres where people were saying our radios don't, I mean, really 20th century technology, our radios don't communicate well with each other. People are taking their private mobile phones to the front, so to speak, which of course is an absolute no-no in terms of military intelligence. All of those things is that's something we have to relearn, that our military have to relearn, and then they've got to coordinate better. I mean, but again, that's something which we've talked about for the last 20 years. Europeans are spending too little, but they're also spending it badly and don't coordinate well enough.
They are changing slightly, though. We're looking at PESCO, the new drive from within the member states in the European Union to improve things such as travel, ridiculous things such as moving equipment over borders, being able to communicate effectively. Some have argued that the new PESCO agreement is perhaps a direct result of the fact that the United Kingdom is no longer there to try to keep things nationally divided. But Marie, do we look at something like the European Union now, driven by the likes of France and Germany, who could perhaps take a new initiative that NATO hasn't quite managed to achieve yet?
Well, the military capability is at the moment with NATO, not with the EU. And it's true that at the moment the EU countries have armies, but if I understand, sometimes they have the same gadget in many countries, and we don't need that many if we go to war with someone. For example, we might have too many tanks or too many something that in the end we would just basically have to store if we ever go onto the ground. So that's money wasted, basically. So perhaps, yes, cooperating more would be a good idea. That's something that the Germans are really pushing for, if I understand. France as well. Well, France said that this gearing up of military power somehow has to be done with lucidity and sustainability. Basically, not going ahead, rushing along and trying to be very strong again, just trying to perhaps manage a bit more management in terms of the soldier training, in terms of the equipment as well, more cooperation between the EU and also communication. It's quite important because we know that for Brexiteers, the idea of European army was very much an argument against the EU, saying that your son going to be conscripted to go to war for Europe. That's something that worked very well, of course. So they have to perhaps put the emphasis on the communication. Why should European countries work more together in order to have perhaps more military might just in case? That's quite
you
important.
Mean marketing, don't you? You don't mean communication, you mean marketing. We need to, and that's absolutely true. I mean, the problem for Germany is that people are pacifist to a dangerous extent, I honestly think these days.
Well, let us stay with this idea of pacifying and examine a subject, or indeed a word, which has been used a lot recently, appeasement. The French president, Emmanuel Macron, has called for restraint and appeasement when he was talking to his Iranian counterpart, Hassan Rouhani, earlier on this week. Donald Trump's fans have called for an end of appeasement towards the Palestinians, and a right-wing politician in Germany has accused the police in Cologne of appeasement towards Muslims. That politician, by the way, has been charged with racial hatred. So why is appeasement becoming such a widely used word, and is it such a bad thing if it is? Well, Sebastian, this is a subject dear to your heart. Could you possibly define appeasement for us? We were having a discussion before we came on air saying, is it making concessions? Is it assuaging? Is it pacifying? Or is it giving into blackmail?
Well, of course, the term derives from the 1930s when appeasement was what the British government did towards Germany, towards Hitler's Germany. The background was that both Britain and France had, after some years, sometimes a little bit reluctantly, I think in France's case, come round to the idea that the Treaty of Versailles had been bad in terms of, making peace, and that there were German minorities in some countries in Central and Eastern Europe, which weren't happy and needed to be pacified, so to speak. Now, what appeasement meant was we are dealing with serious concerns and we are trying to find a solution for those. What it then came to mean, of course, we are giving, as you say, we are giving in to the blackmail of a dictator who turned out to be a mass murderer of enormous extent. I think the what is being mixed up in the political debate is that the policy in the 1930s was correct in the way the analysis was correct. The Versailles Treaty was bad. It had some of the aims of Germany beyond Hitler. I mean, that went beyond Hitler. Were correct. You had to bring Germany back into the concert of powers as it then was. What gets forgotten during all of that is that at least the British government did take steps towards also containing Germany. From 1936, there was rearmament. There was in 1937 actually a specified tax for rearmament. There was when Chamberlain became Prime Minister, he had an agreement with the unions to make it possible to quicker build more planes and tanks, etc. The problem is it failed because of Hitler. But I find it just interesting that a concept, a policy concept, which seems right rationally, which is totally supported by the population. Both. I mean, Robert Harris has recently written this fabulous new thriller called Munich, about the Munich Conference in September 1938. And he makes it very clear how popular Chamberlain was in Germany. In Germany, the Germans didn't want war, nor did the Brits. So to search for a solution to avoid war was correct. It didn't, and therefore it's been a discredited concept. I think unfairly.
Has it been a discredited concept? Because we're looking, Mary, at what some might consider to be a necessary part of life. When you require when you need to calm a situation down, for however long, adults have given an angry baby a pacifier in order to calm him or her down. A small puppy.
Can we use one for Trump?
A small puppy is given a shiny ball to stop it from wrecking the furniture. It imposes perhaps a kind of a moral superiority on the person who tries to appease, but does it make them feel or come across as weaker?
Well, I guess depending on the situation, it might. I mean, in terms of how we look behind, basically, for history, we see Chamberlain as the weakest point against Hitler, him having not understood how bad Hitler was. And I think that's the point with the way we use appeasement today, at least the way perhaps the German AfD people used it. It seems like they have... Perhaps in general, but this in particular, it derives from a very black and white view of the world. There are bad people and there are good people. And they say that the migrants are bad people. They are raping, they are stealing. That's the way they want to see them, as only bad people. So yes, of course, trying to appease them, trying to make concession to them is not perhaps a good idea. The problem is, of course, migrants are not all bad people. So it's normal that you basically stretch the hand of friendship to them, because not all of them are bad again. So appeasement has to be seen as a bit more widely, in a way. Not to forget that the world is not black and white. There's always a lot of grey, and that's where appeasement can be useful, can be used. But again, make sure that you don't forget the subtlety of this word, and of this world.
You say, Sebastian, that appeasement has been getting some bad press recently, and you say unjustifiably. Is it because we are living in an age at the moment where protectionism lines are being drawn, there are threats of walls being built, countries look back towards themselves and their own interests, and the idea of actually being seen to proffer a hand externally does not necessarily appear to be a sign of strength towards some political supporters? Appeasement becomes a political position as opposed to a political tool.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you quoted Macron talking about appeasement in Iran. It's one of those situations where a government is confronted with protesters and you have a range of responses to that. But we talked about the NATO thing earlier. I mean, you could argue, I suppose, that there is an appeasement route in terms of mooring, and people do argue that, particularly in Germany, in terms of more engagement with Russia and trying to take the aggression out of the situation, as you described with toddlers. I just find it fascinating. This term is being abused, but it's been abused for ever since Churchill abused it by writing the history of the 1930s here in Britain.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Mary Bion and Sebastian Burger are our guests today. And coming up next, we all check who's got the biggest button.
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around!
It's 18:21 here in London. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House. It's Emma Nelson here, joined by Marie Bion and Sebastian Burger. Now, Donald Trump inspired a wealth of unwelcome mental images earlier this week when he did the military equivalent of dropping his trousers and showing North Korea just what he was made of. My nuclear button, he boasted across the internet to Kim Jong-un, is bigger than yours. Well, when I heard that, Marie, I was not necessarily that surprised, but there's a little bit of me that thought that actually that sort of brings together all the subjects that we've been talking about today. NATO and Russia, my tanks can move faster than your tanks. Appeasement, your guns may be bigger than my guns, but I'm going to give you something nice so that you don't shoot me. The fact is that although it lacks eloquence... it's an understatement. Yes. There is a refreshing frankness to it, isn't there?
Oh, I beg to disagree, I must say. No, there's nothing fresh or refreshing or anything nice about this. It's so, I mean, the only word that comes to my mind when I read that is, really? Really? Is it really? Do you really want to say what you're implying, or are you just, I don't know, basically I was lost for word. I mean, it's not surprising, as you said, from Donald Trump. It's not the first time he's boasting about the size of his genitals. It talks about his hands, talk about his genitals very more directly also. And this time, but the problem is that this time in particular, it is so dangerous. I mean, it's really, it's like having a toddler playing with a real gun that's loaded. And he's just, you know, waving it around and mommy and daddy are around and saying, oh, that's refreshing to see him with a gun. It's very unsettling to see that that someone who's supposed to be the leader of the free world is not only callous enough to talk about his genitals on Twitter, but also callous enough.
I think it was
enough.
His nuclear button, but I think I'll take what you mean. Right?
Well, I think everybody thinks about the same thing. I mean, it's like, I'm just putting real
well,
word on what
well,
he said.
Well.
But the only thing is that I think seeing him talking about nuclear war in such a non-understating tone is what is the most worrying. He might be not exactly very polite or subtle in the way he speaks, but he's talking about a weapon that could kill millions of people.
Well, can I just say, I mean, we don't need to, in a way, I find, we're having an interesting debate in Germany about whether to actually ignore Donald Trump's tweets. I know it doesn't quite work. But can I just say the approach he has taken is at least as successful as any US president has tried over the last 25 years. Let's not forget that. We are confronted with a regime which has consistently ignored any UN resolutions, which starves its people, which is clearly, it must be supported by China as a pawn in China's chess game with America. And you talk about nuclear war. We don't need to talk about nuclear war. If there is war on the Korean Peninsula, you just need the North Korean artillery to wipe out a number of big cities led by Seoul with 20 million people, and we have millions of casualties. So any talk of war is awful, but at the same time, we are confronted with a regime which simply does not adhere to any rules of the international community.
Sebastian, if only Kim Jong-un's head was as cool as yours. I mean, you talk about the idea that, you know, we are learning to ignore Donald Trump. The trouble is that Kim Jong-un doesn't. I mean, he himself, I mean, we can't elevate him any higher than Donald Trump, insofar as he said his button is on the table as well. And you say that, you know, let's not worry about nuclear war. It has possibly made people face it, but it's also brought the prospect of someone accidentally pushing that button much closer.
Well, I mean, we still, I don't know about the ins and outs of the North Korean regime. Let's not, again, the little I know about it is that this guy is under tremendous pressure from his own military and his own tiny elite of people. And Trump, at the same time, of course, is highly boxed in within the political military system of the U.S. He's not the button is not now. Let's leave aside all sexual allusions. The nuclear button is actually not on his table, and it would have to be a very long drawn out decision within the administration before anything of that kind would happen.
Let's finally move on to the emergence of women in a leading role. Male American breakfast TV hosts haven't covered themselves in glory lately. Charlie Rose of CBS This Morning was sacked following claims of sexual misconduct. Shortly after that, Matt Lauer of NBC's Today programme was fired for doing pretty much the same thing. And when Matt Lauer was thrown out, Hoda Kotb, known to followers as the host of one of the later hours of the programme, was dragged from her bed and shoved on set to stand in for him and carry the show. Well, now it's been announced she's to take over permanently, co-hosting alongside Savannah Guthrie. And for the first time, two women will be the permanent hosts of one of the US's biggest breakfast programmes. Murray, this can be nothing but good news, one would say.
Well, yes, I guess. I mean, having two women presenting one of the most watched morning programme in the US, I guess, yes. If she, as long as she's a good journalist, that's quite important not to forget. I've don't watch the two-day programme, so I can't say if she's good or not, but apparently she is. So as long as Savannah and her are very good, yes, that's great that these are two women. And she's 53, so she's not a young woman as well. That's quite important to say. But what I read is, of course, I didn't ask her how much she would be paid, but she'll be paid the same as Savannah, which is $7 million a year, which is quite a lot.
That's but not the $25 million that Matt Lauer used to get.
Yes, indeed. But they said he's been there for 25 years. I mean, it's been a long time since he's been around. Yes, of course. So yeah, that's opening another debate. So good news, yes, but look between the lines.
Now, let's briefly looking at the United Kingdom. Sarah Sands was appointed as editor of the Today programme, the flagship Radio 4 breakfast programme, a little while ago. And immediately afterwards, people were accusing her of softening the agenda. Sebastian, are we worried that news will get soft if girls are in charge?
I tell you what, I do not worry about any, the US breakfast television anyway, but I don't worry about any breakfast television. It's a complete abomination of mankind. You should never, ever, ever, ever watch television before 9 o'clock in the morning. Radio, just about you can, I can just about have people's very nice voices in my ear, but not see them on the screen. Seriously, we don't want that.
Even regardless of their gender?
Absolutely. I don't care how old they are. Oh, by the way, I mean, I need to apply for the next job because I think I fit the profile. I'm 53 and I'm, you know, I'm sort of...
You've got a strong pair of upper arms, which is what appears to be the uniform of the American television presenter. On that note, that brings us to the end of today's show. My thanks to Mary Billon and Sebastian Borger for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Henry Rees Sheridan, research by Fernanda Augusta Pacheco, Leah Fournier, Katie Mendoza, and James Kitchen, and our studio manager was George McDonough. More music next, and at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs with Matt Allagaya. We'll have more on the day's main stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, that's 1800 London time. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.